The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, a podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school. As always, we invite you to submit your questions about how our democracy works through our listener line, email, Twitter, and our website, which is how we got today's question.
Hello, my name is Elise, and I am from Anchorage, Alaska.
This is David from Georgetown, Texas.
This is Tracy from Hanover, Pennsylvania.
My name is Em, and I'm calling from Pensacola, Florida.
I was hoping you could help me understand what congressional caucuses are.
Considering the current impact on healthcare legislation.
Are caucuses really that powerful?
How are they formed? Why did they form?
And can they really make that much difference?
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work. Bye-bye.
Our guide for today's lesson is Colleen Shogan. She's Deputy Director of Outreach at the Library of Congress. So, Colleen, ready to go?
Absolutely.
What is a congressional caucus?
A congressional caucus is a formal organization in Congress, neither the House or Senate, that brings together members of Congress who share a common interest.
Now, you say formal. What's the difference between a congressional committee and a caucus?
The committee system is actually the vehicle in which legislation is produced in the House or the Senate. The committee system is where there's formal hearings that take place. There's the consideration, like I said, of legislation, and legislation makes its way through the process of being considered in either House of Congress. Congressional caucuses don't have that type of formal authority within the House or the Senate. They're more of a place in which members can come together to discuss a particular issue or common interest.
What is that process? I mean, it sounds a little bit like a club.
It is. It's like a congressional club, although, like I said, it's a formal club in that you're registering with the Committee on House Administration, which is the committee in the House that manages the day-to-day operations. They're on a whole range of interests. So there's a congressional caucus on bicycles, for example. There's a congressional caucus on candy, which I thought was kind of interesting. There's very serious things such as human trafficking. There's one on bourbon. There's one on baseball. So they range the entire gamut of interests that might really be relevant to members personally, or they might be relevant to the constituents that members are representing. If you would like to start a congressional caucus and you're a member of Congress, you would simply write a letter to the Committee on House Administration explaining who the leader or leaders of the caucus will be, what the purpose of the caucus is, what the title of the caucus is, and who the congressional staff point of contact is for the caucus.
All right, so I'm a member of Congress, and I join a caucus. So what happens next? I mean, am I expected to do anything? Do they hold any formal meetings or power?
There's a lot of caucuses in both the House and the Senate. They have various occasions on which to meet. Some caucuses meet very regularly. Some would meet every week. Other caucuses would meet perhaps on a monthly basis. Others maybe three or four times a year. And some caucuses probably meet very rarely. So there's the whole range. And if you're a member that is joining a caucus, it's really up to you how involved you might want to be. You might want to go to all of the meetings or functions that are organized by the caucus, or you might want to go to just select meetings or caucuses.
You mentioned there are many. How many?
There's over 300 registered caucuses or congressional member organizations in the House of Representatives.
Are they connected to legislative work in any real way?
Not formally. There's no role for caucuses in the legislative process per se. So a lot of bills make their way through Congress without ever having been touched necessarily by a congressional caucus. But they can have a role. In fact, it's more likely. There's been some research done on the role of congressional caucuses. And what was found was that if congressional caucuses do become involved in the legislative process, they're usually involved very early on in the process. So when members or staff are just starting to figure out that they want to perhaps write a bill, or if they want to write an amendment about a particular topic or subject, it might be the case that if they're a member of a caucus, that's the first place that they start in which they can discuss, you know, informally in a way about what they might want to write. But as the bill moves through the formal legislative process, the caucus becomes less involved.
Or in the case of the replacement for the Affordable Care Act proposed by the Republicans more recently, the Freedom Caucus was said to have shot that down. Is there any real legislative authority for a caucus?
No, there's no legislative authority for a caucus. In the case of the House Freedom Caucus, that's a group of House Republicans of like-minded members coming together and having a discussion really about a bill, a particular bill, and then deciding collectively about what their particular stance or opinion of that bill is. But that would be no different than a group of members meeting, you know, at one of our Capitol Hill bars that are, you know, close to the House of Representatives, and sitting down and having a drink and deciding that they do or don't want to support a particular bill.
But there's something about caucus. There's something about binding together people in this group, informal though it may be, that can actually exert real power, correct?
Absolutely. That would be the case for any group of members or senators, by the way. I think a few years ago, we were talking about this in the context of judicial nominations with the Gang of Six in the Senate. So any grouping of members that gets together and decides to want to, like I said, advocate or oppose a particular piece of legislation, if the margins in either house, in the House of Representatives or the Senate, are close enough, then any group of members that bands together, whether they're of one party or they're bipartisan, can certainly have an effect.
Do caucuses generally form by party or around bipartisan causes?
They are generally not formed around party. In fact, out of the 300 caucuses that are registered with the Committee on House Administration, in last Congress, I checked, and only 8 of them were organized by party.
Although there are some, from what I understand, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, which is run by a Democrat, and the Congressional Hispanic Conference run by Republicans, if I've got that right.
I think that's right. That's correct.
So they can be bipartisan too.
Yes, they can. Yeah, and the vast majority of them that are organized around an issue area, like we were talking about before, whether it's something that they're advocating for, like the Steelmakers Caucus, a particular region of the country, or a particular interest in diplomacy, such as the Congressional UK Caucus, those are all going to be bipartisan organizations, usually with a Republican co-chair and a Democratic co-chair.
So you mentioned rules about governing caucuses and their formation. What are some of the others? What can they and cannot they do?
Well, if you're registered as a congressional member organization, that's the actual formal title for a caucus, congressional member organization, or a CMO. If you're registered as a CMO in the House, then you can do certain things. You can, for example, list your affiliation with the caucus on your official stationery. You can mention your caucus affiliation on your official member website. What you can't do is spend any of your official representational money, your members' representational allowance, which you're given to spend for the operations of your office. You're not allowed to spend any of that money to run the caucus.
So stationery, that's the perk?
That's why you can also send out letters within the House. They're called Dear Colleague Letters, and they advertise meetings, they advertise amendments, they advertise pieces of legislation. If you're a official congressional member organization, you can make use of the Dear Colleague system, which is quite powerful because that's a way to reach all 435 members of Congress, 441 if you count the delegates, all in one swoop, just by pressing a button and just by sending the letter. So that's pretty powerful.
So why, Colleen, join a caucus? I mean, what is the real benefit for a member of Congress?
I think there's, and by the way, members join a fair number of caucuses. So there's a reason why they're doing it and they're spending their time to do it. There's two, I think, parts to a member of Congress's job. One is to represent his or her constituents, and the other is to hopefully produce good public policy for the United States. And I think caucuses help members do both. Sometimes members join caucuses. I'll go back to, you know, an industry caucus of some sort, like automobile makers caucus. They join that caucus because they're representing constituents who work in that particular industry. So by joining a caucus, they feel as though they're going to get better information about how they can represent the interests of their constituents better. So that's the first reason. And the second reason would be a policymaking or legislative function. Perhaps a member in that particular district does not sit on the relevant committee where there would be legislation concerning the manufacture of cars in the United States. Perhaps he or she is not given that committee assignment. They can join the Automobile Makers Caucus so they can have a way in which they can hopefully meet other members who are interested in that particular issue area and perhaps offer an amendment or co-sponsor a bill that will be relevant to their interests.
Okay, so appeal to constituents, pretty good networking opportunity, it sounds like. These informal relationships can be quite strategic. What do you think, Colleen, is the most important takeaway for our listeners? What should they know about congressional caucuses?
I think that even though some congressional caucuses that grab a lot of the headlines are the partisan caucuses that we hear a lot about, the vast majority of caucuses are bipartisan, and they're a way for members of Congress to gather information and a way for them to hopefully represent constituents better.
Colleen Shogan, thank you for leading our lesson.
Thank you.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The push to remove Confederate statues from public spaces came to a head in New Orleans, where four monuments are being dismantled.
It's the dark of night. Workers in helmets and tactical vests tearing down a Confederate memorial in New Orleans. Security so tight, police snipers looked on from surrounding rooftops.
We are, of course, elated that this monument is coming down. But again, we say that this is a cowardice, that this is happening in the middle of the night.
CNN reporting there on confrontations between protesters at a statue marking the Battle of Liberty Place, erected in 1891 to commemorate an attempted insurrection by the White League against the Reconstruction-era government. Local officials have received death threats for removing the monument, which has been used as a rallying point for the Klan. It is something you might expect in the Deep South, but David Graham wrote about the persistence of Confederate monuments and commemorations throughout the country and dug into the arguments between those who want to preserve them and those fighting to take them down. He's staff writer for The Atlantic, and we reached him on Skype. David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I know there have been calls in New Orleans for decades to take down the Monument at Liberty Place, Lee Circle, Jefferson Davis, and others. What has changed?
I think there's been an interesting sea change, and it's hard to know exactly what the turning point was, particularly for New Orleans. I do think that the shooting in Charleston last year did make a lot of difference. It forced people to reconsider what these monuments meant and what they were doing. And I think that kind of publicity changed some folks' minds and more than that created a political incentive to start pulling them down.
Right, as they did at the South Carolina Capitol and in Alabama. How many Confederate-related monuments in school are still in the U.S. and where are they?
So the Southern Poverty Law Center did a tally last year, and they came up with about 1,500 of them across 31 states. not just in the Deep South, but in the Upper South and in the Midwest and in the Pacific Northwest, really across the country, including states that fought for the Union and sent many soldiers to die in the war.
I have to admit, I was a little surprised by that. 31 states and so many.
Yeah, and one reason there are so many is it's a wide range of things. So that's everything from the enormous sculpture at Stone Mountain, Georgia of Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and bas-relief on a mountainside to, you know, really ordinary little monuments, the sort of standard courthouse statue, and even names of schools. You get a lot of schools named after people like Robert E. Lee across the country.
Well, and you mentioned that the most egregious are the schools. What makes them especially offensive?
I think there are a couple things. You know, it's one thing to memorialize the dead at a county courthouse, for example. But you're going out of the way to celebrate rebellion in a venue that has nothing to do with the war. And in many cases, these are schools that have large populations of black students. The really scary ones are places named after Nathan Bedford Forrest, for example, who was a renowned cavalry general and then later the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And so to have these schools that black students are attending, you know, dedicated to a man who, one, participated in a treasonous rebellion against the United States, and then, two, was a leading white supremacist after the war, and also was accused of war crimes for killing black soldiers during the war, it's really an appalling juxtaposition.
The argument against taking these monuments down is that with each removal, we're erasing or rewriting history, that they represent heritage, not necessarily hate. So what is the counterargument?
I do think that you have to divide these monuments. It's not enough to say all monuments are acceptable or all of them are bad. The argument that you need to recognize history is, I think, a potent one. And I think you can make a lot stronger argument for those sort of local monuments or memorials to specific people than you can for some other things. But I look at a place like Monument Avenue in Richmond, Virginia, which is this long row of huge sculptures to Confederate heroes, which has been controversial over the years. Some years ago, a statue of Arthur Ashe, a local hero, was erected nearby, which was meant to somehow solve the problem. And the argument, again, about a place like Monument Avenue, I think, is difficult to take. You know, is it really marking history and revealing what happened in the past? Or is it, in fact, continuing to glorify Confederate generals and leaders who led a war against the United States in order to preserve slavery?
Well, and Arthur Ashe, again, he is a black tennis star, an African-American in tennis. But that is a question. How do you distinguish between, say, an historical marker at a Civil War battlefield and a monument that glorifies or lionizes the Confederate cause?
Yeah, to me, the battlefield question is much easier. I think, you know, we've always marked battlefields. Even then, though, there's a difference in the way battlefields are handled. Several years ago, then Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. went on a tour of battlefields in the South and was shocked to realize how few battlefields actually discussed what the cause of the war was and discussed slavery, and they sort of glorify the battles. So there are ways to mark battlefields in ways that are educational and even-handed. But those are also separate from, you know, enormous statues to people like Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis in the center of cities, or for that matter, the Confederate flag flying over the state capitol in South Carolina.
It's been interesting also to read the variety of comments to your article for The Atlantic. I mean, readers in some cases taking a stand on what the war was about, or in some cases grappling with why the Civil War was fought.
That's right. And I think that, you know, the questions about why the Civil War were fought are less helpful. You know, this is a debate that rages but has really been fairly well decided. But I think there are some more interesting and thoughtful arguments. You know, one reader emailed me to say, look, I think that the war was wrong. It was a mistake, but my ancestors fought for that flawed cause, and I think it's important that we mark that. You know, and even though they were mistaken, you know, I'm proud that my ancestors were willing to fight in this war. I think it's an understandable impulse to want to honor your ancestors. But the question is whether you're doing that privately or whether a government should be doing that.
Well, and it's revealing in many ways to find out when they were built, which was also surprising to me. Some of them in the 1960s, when the battle for civil rights in America was raging.
That's right. A lot of these monuments went up in two sort of waves, and one of those is in the at the end of the 19th century and in the early 20th century. Now, on the one hand, that's 30 and 40 year anniversaries of the war, and so there was a natural impulse to remember. But that's also at a time when Jim Crow rules were being enacted very quickly, and segregation was being enforced, and Reconstruction was being dismantled. And so the context is celebrating the South and celebrating the Confederacy at this moment. The other time is in the 1960s and to some extent in the 1950s. It's defiance by Southern governments, Southern governors, against the federal government and against the ideas of integration. So a lot of these monuments, although we see them now as some sort of historical commemoration of the war, were really erected to send a political message in that time. And that message was white supremacy and opposition to civil rights and integration.
Well, although you mentioned, David, that the tide may have turned with the Dylann Roof conviction and slaughter, really, at the AME Baptist Church, at the same time, white nationalist movement is much more visible and vocal. Do you think any of those clashes at these monuments is about maybe a backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, criminal justice reform, looking at race in a different way?
I think that's undoubtedly true. There are open discussions about race and aspects of race in ways there have not been for some time. That Black Lives Matter has brought up. And a lot of people are uncomfortable with that. And that ranges from, you know, the sons of Confederate veterans at these monuments trying to prevent their removal to, you know, the things that President Trump said on the campaign trail about Blue Lives Matter and complaining about the assaults on police and saying that, you know, racism had nothing to do with it. There's a full range. But I think whenever you have a conversation like this, there's going to be a little bit of backlash, and that's what we're seeing.
David, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David Graham, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He wrote The Stubborn Persistence of Confederate Monuments. And you'll find a link to read the piece at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Keep calm and carry on. Keep calm and blog on. Keep calm and call mom. The slogan, conceived to boost the morale of Britons on the brink of World War II, has been adapted for everything from crafting to escaping zombies. It exploded onto T-shirts and mugs after a pair of English bookshop owners discovered one of the vintage posters in a box. The internet took it from there. Henry Irving wrote an article about the origins of the famous phrase for the conversation and joins us to explain how the formula promoting a stiff upper lip rocketed to worldwide fame. Henry, thank you for joining us.
Oh, that's quite right. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us the story of the discovery in Northumberland of the Keep Calm and Carry On poster.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting story, actually. It's two antiquarian bookshop owners in a very small village called Alnwick, which is a very pretty village in Northumberland in the northeast of England, came across one of the posters almost by accident at the bottom of a box of books that they'd bought at an auction. And they seemed to come across this, weren't really sure what it was, but liked the design so much that they decided to put it up in their shop. And they soon had so many people asking them about the provenance and about whether there were copies available that they started producing their own versions.
Well, what is the provenance of the poster?
Well, the poster itself was designed in 1939. It was designed as part of a series of three posters, which would be issued by the British government if war were to be declared. So this was part of wider preparations for the Second World War. The thing about the poster, though, which is, I suppose, quite interesting, is that it wasn't actually displayed during the war itself. Most of the copies were destroyed, and only a couple have survived, and it's one of those copies that they found in the box.
It was never used then. Why?
The thing about the Keep Calm, Carry On poster is that the tone was never seen to be quite right. So there were a lot of fears that this was not the right message, that it wasn't the right time, and that it simply wouldn't be wouldn't be heeded by the British public.
What do you mean the tone was not right? I mean, now it seems to symbolize everything absolutely British. You know, keep calm, carry on.
Quite. I think this is one of the really interesting paradoxes about the poster, because it says so much about that sort of British sense of restraint, that almost sort of stiff upper lip attitude. But during the preparations for the Second World War, it was seen almost to be, it was seen as being quite impersonal, quite passive. And actually the public was seen to be wanting something much more active, something which would allow them to really get involved. And it was those questions that really led them to decide not to issue this poster when war was declared in September 1939.
To our ears now, or our eyes now, it may seem very, I don't know, Orwellian in a way, you know, reinforcing behavior by means of a poster.
Yeah, quite. And this is really one of the issues that's at the heart of our project. So the Ministry of Information that was responsible for the Keep Calm and Carry On poster, this was the ministry that gave George Orwell the inspiration to create the Ministry of Truth in the novel 1984. So there are those real Orwellian overtones throughout a lot of this work.
Okay, so the tone wasn't quite right by the wartime government, but isn't that exactly what makes it so applicable to so many other uses?
I think so. And certainly as we've been doing research into the poster and thinking about the way that it's become such a sort of cultural icon in recent years, it's the fact that it can be sort of turned to so many different uses that's really helped with that. I mean, the design is obviously important. The fact that this is all text, that means that it's very easy to manipulate. But then in terms of its actual, the tone, the tempo and the way that it sounds, it can be very easily manipulated by people, applied to a whole range of different products and different scenarios.
Henry, you mentioned that it was one in a series of posters. What were some of the other sayings or slogans?
Well, to begin with, Keep Calm and Carry On was designed as one of three posters. The first read, "Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory," which is quite a mouthful.
Cheerfulness leads to victory. Interesting.
That's quite right. And then the second was, "Freedom is in peril, defend it with all your might." The first, which was the Your Courage poster, that was again criticized for being quite impassive and also for almost enforcing a class distinction between your courage and our victory. Mm. And then the Freedom is in Peril poster was seen as being far too academic, too abstract.
And as if Britons wouldn't be courageous and cheerful as it was.
And that's quite right. There was a real fear that people would be angry that their courage was being doubted. This is an era when mass communication was coming to the fore, but there was still a bit of a hesitancy and still a real disdain for anything that could be labelled as propaganda.
There was a copyright battle over the design beginning in 2011, so I guess a full decade after its discovery. Who does own it?
One of the really interesting questions that we've still not been able to completely clear up. Now, anything which is produced by the British government is officially covered by Crown copyright. One of the interesting things about this poster and many of the others is that because they were produced almost in secret by a quasi-government department, there's a lot of questions over whether Crown copyright actually applies. The British government don't claim ownership of the poster. They see it as being in the public domain. But the copyright battle was almost sort of precipitated by that, because it meant that the rights were almost up for grabs. So when the poster was rediscovered in 2001, you had two competing claims for ownership. I think the UK courts decided that nobody owned it, but the situation in Europe and also in America was slightly more contested, which led to that very fierce copyright battle in 2011 to 2013.
Do you have any favourite variations on the phrase?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I think my favourite variation is probably the sign that I used to pass on my way to work that said, "Keep calm, order signage." I think it's just so abstract that it's probably my favourite version.
What was that for, like an engraver or something?
It was for engravers, yes.
It just rolls off the tongue. Henry Irving, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Lovely to speak to you. Thank you, Virginia.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions and Broke for Free. There is loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio, on Twitter at Word of Mouth, and you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play for the podcast. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.